In the following podcast from 9.com.au, we are not suggesting Kate and Jerry McCann were responsible for what happened to Maddie or are lying. Her case is simply a mystery, but they were considered suspects by the Portuguese police, and we examine why that was and why the questions about what happened to Maddie haven't gone away.
We're just hearing that a search is underway for a three-year-old British girl who's gone missing in the Algarve area of Portugal.
Someone's taken her. Madeline's gone.
Words cannot describe the anguish and despair that we are feeling as the parents of our beautiful daughter, Madeline.
Parents of Madeline McCann are now considered formal suspects by the Portuguese police authorities.
We have played no part in the disappearance of our lovely daughter, Madeline.
There are days when you just want to get under the duvet or just want to be in a coma till it's over, just to relieve the pain and get some peace, but you can't.
On Sunday, November 29, 2010, newsrooms around the world lit up and began reporting a story that would leave White House officials both anxious and furious. The story's impact and its potential for diplomatic embarrassment would be widely felt, as British broadcaster ITN made clear.
The bombshell many governments across the world have been waiting for finally drops. WikiLeaks is the website that lets whistleblowers pass on secret documents to journalists anonymously. It's already been the source of a number of embarrassing exposés. Now its Australian founder, Julian Assange, can claim his greatest coup yet. A quarter of a million confidential cables sent by US diplomats have been released to five newspapers. They contain many explosive claims that were never intended to be made public.
Buried in amongst that avalanche of 250,000 US embassy cables was one cable about Madeline McCann. It was marked confidential. The cable had been sent to Washington from the US embassy in Portugal. The US ambassador, Al Hoffman, had just met with the freshly appointed British ambassador, Alexander Ellis. The cable that detailed their meeting was typed up on September 21, 2007. 2 weeks after Kate and Jerry had been declared arguidos, formal suspects, in the disappearance of their daughter. US Ambassador Al Hoffman wrote and reported the following to Washington.
Without delving into the details of the case, Ellis admitted that the British police had developed the current evidence against the McCann parents, and he stressed that authorities from both countries were working cooperatively. He commented that the media frenzy was to be expected and was acceptable as long as government officials keep their comments behind closed doors.
The evidence that had been developed against the McCanns by British police. That statement was largely referring to work done by two highly trained British Springer Spaniel dogs named Eddie and Keela, and the UK's top police search expert, Mark Harrison. The two dogs were brought to Portugal to hunt for human blood and the scent of death in the summer of 2007, 3 months after Maddie vanished. After the dogs searched the McCann's holiday apartment, the family's rental car, and various personal belongings, the investigation turned dramatically against Kate and Jerry McCann. The leaked diplomatic cable was interesting on another level too. The general thinking all along was that it was Gonzalo Amaral and the Portuguese police who had driven the investigation towards a theory that the McCanns could have been involved in Maddie's disappearance. But the cable highlighting British police work seemed to debunk that idea. So exactly what happened when the two dogs arrived in Praia da Luz, and where and what did the dogs seem to be alerting to?
My name is Mark Salnoconoco, and I'm a reporter for 9.com.au, and this is a podcast called Maddie. The Maddie podcast series explores what many believe is the well-known story of Madeline McCann's disappearance. But this is an investigation of the evidence that could make you question everything you thought you knew about the case.
Anyone reviewing media reporting on the Maddie case will inevitably come across the phrase turning point. And the turning point comes after the dogs, Eddie and Keela, arrived in Praia da Luz 3 months after Maddie vanished. The dogs conducted their searches of the McCann Holiday Apartment 5A and a Renault Scenic hire car. 1 month after the dogs' intensive eight-day mission had concluded, police declared the McCanns arguidos. But the dogs also marked a turning point in a less obvious way. Their arrival in Portugal, along with Mark Harrison, the UK police search expert, ultimately marked a shift from looking for an abducted girl who could still be alive to searching for a dead girl who may have been disposed of somewhere around the coastal town or in the ocean. The Portuguese police made enormous efforts to find Madeline, but despite this, the 14-month investigation was often portrayed by UK media as flawed, second-rate, and much worse. During a conversation I had with retired homicide detective Colin Sutton, who led more than 30 successful murder investigations for London's Met Police Force, I asked him about the Portuguese police investigation. Was there more they could have and should have done?
To be honest, Mark, you know, from what I've seen of it and the time I spent looking at it, I'm not so sure that the Portuguese investigation was as bad as it's been painted. And I don't think it's the shoddy, incomplete investigation that some people paint it as. But I'm not sure what else they could have done. They took statements very, very quickly. They looked into it. They investigated it. They interviewed. They did forensic work as best they could. Sometimes the evidence just isn't there. Sometimes you just actually can't prove what you're trying to prove.
So, very broadly, let's look at what the Portuguese police did. Firstly, there appears to be some confusion over when police were first called. It was claimed police were called just after 10 p.m. on the night Maddie vanished. However, police telephone call logs seem to show that they were not contacted until a call was received at 10:41 p.m. According to Kate, she found Maddie gone when she checked on her at 10 p.m. The McCanns had always complained how long it took police to arrive. Members of Portugal's GNR, the National Republican Guard, were the first to arrive at the crime scene at apartment 5A around 11 p.m. During the investigation, and even to this day, Portugal's police have been accused of not closing off the crime scene quickly enough, leading to the potential destruction of what might be important forensic clues. However, on their arrival, GNR officers reported Maddie's bedroom window had already been touched, and the McCanns and their friends had naturally enough been moving in and out of Maddie's bedroom. Remember, this was a nightmare scenario. A small 3-year-old girl had just gone missing. Kate, Jerry, their friends and employees from the Ocean Club Resort had frantically searched the apartment and Maddie's room. They were touching things, opening wardrobes, moving furniture. At 10 minutes past midnight, an hour after the GNR's arrival, and 90 minutes after the first logged phone call, Portugal's official police, the Polícia Judiciária, the PJ, turned up. An inspector and forensic expert entered apartment 5A. Immediately, the apartment, already heavily rummaged over, was closed off. Police sent alerts to nearby Faro International Airport, the primary Algarve hub for flights into cities across Europe. A control post was set up on a key bridge on the Portugal-Spain border, which was about 90 minutes' drive to the east of Praia da Luz. In the meantime, well into the hours after midnight, GNR officers, two sniffer dogs and local residents conducted an unsuccessful search of the surrounding streets, the town, and the beach. In the first 24 hours, 130 police officers and emergency services personnel searched for Maddie. That number ballooned to more than 300 police officers and officials in the next 24 hours. In the days and weeks that followed, 443 doors were knocked on and 700 people were interviewed, including 112 employees of the resort. The search radius grew from 15 to 30 square kilometres, with a focus on abandoned wells, passages, tunnels, reservoirs and lakes scattered over the challenging surrounding area. Helicopters, planes and boats swept the Mediterranean coastline. Despite holding out hope that Maddie might be found alive, Portuguese police had to consider all options. Something else could have happened to Maddie. Something sinister. Soon after Maddie went missing, a small team of Leicestershire police officers decamped to Praia da Luz from England. They were there to assist the Portuguese. This unusual move, deployment and direct involvement in a sovereign nation's investigation, it didn't always sit well with lead detective Gonzalo Amaral. But he relented and he agreed. Maddie was the priority. And the British would bring more eyeballs, more manpower. But the truth was, the Maddie case was quickly politicised. Chancellor of the Exchequer, Gordon Brown, who was about to succeed Tony Blair as UK Prime Minister, was in direct contact with Kate and Jerry McCann soon after May 3.
Praia da Luz, it's a small town with a lot of English people living there. Portugal and England are countries with an enormous historical past of working together in many fronts. And UK is very important for Portugal. So I would say that Portuguese authorities accept very easily the British intervention on that case.
That's Duarte Levy, a Portuguese journalist who covered the Maddie case for local media and British newspaper, The Times. He explained the involvement of the Leicestershire police and how, in hindsight, some Portuguese police felt the British had interfered in the investigation. I also asked Duarte if he had adopted a theory about what might have happened to Maddie. I had a pretty bad phone connection with Duarte, so forgive the ins and outs of the volume.
I really don't like theories, even if I considered several ones. But, you know, my vision on this case, I always try to work on facts. I look correctly several times at the Portuguese inquiry. They've done everything to try and to elucidate this case. I'm sure that Madeleine today is dead. That's a fact. It's impossible with all the details that the Portuguese inquiry found at the time and after the 2-3 years after that. I would say that Madeleine is dead today. That's for sure. How? By who? It's rather difficult to elaborate a perfect theory.
In April 2016, a former British ambassador to Uzbekistan named Craig Murray wrote a 1,200-word post on his personal blog. In it, he wrote, "I'm going to come straight out with this. British diplomatic staff were under direct instruction to support the McCanns far beyond the usual and to put pressure on the Portuguese authorities over the case. I have direct information that more than one of those diplomatic staff found the McCanns less than convincing and their stories inconsistent. Embassy staff were perturbed to be ordered that British authorities were to be present at every contact between the McCanns and Portuguese police." I've tried to contact Craig Murray a number of times to speak about his hard-hitting blog post, but he has never replied. In one of my phone calls with Colin Sutton, I asked if he believed there had been interference in the Maddie case from the British government. After a pretty long pause, here's what Colin had to say.
I think there is certainly the appearance of interference. I think the fact that the government and diplomats and civil servants got involved at all in such an early stage of the investigation in Portugal is remarkable and unusual. And I don't think any of us is really sure why that would happen. There's a theory that that the government of the day saw it as an opportunity to do something that would capture the public imagination and would make them look good. And you know, it was a good thing for the politicians to get behind. In some ways, I hope that, you know, the answer is that simple.
So who is it Colin Sutton and Craig Murray are talking about when they refer to British diplomats and civil servants descending on Praia da Luz after Maddie vanished? Well, on May 4, less than 24 hours after Maddie disappeared, these government officials travelled to Praia da Luz and met with the McCanns. John Buck, the British ambassador to Portugal, Robert Henderson, the British consul for the Algarve, Angela Morado, the British proconsul, Liz Dow, the British consul for Lisbon, Andy Bowles, a British embassy press officer. On May 4, after Kate and Jerry give their first police statements, those five government officials all gather at the McCann's new apartment, 4G, at the Ocean Club Resort. It seems a significant deployment, less than 24 hours after a young girl goes missing. One day later, on May 5, three representatives from the Leicestershire Police Force arrived. They were there to assist the flow of information between the Portuguese and the McCanns. More police from England would follow. Then, on May 15, the British Foreign Office dispatched Cherie Dodd, a former Fleet Street journalist, to work as a media liaison officer for the McCanns. She would eventually be replaced by the more senior and influential Clarence Mitchell, a former BBC news journalist. Clarence Mitchell was the director of the Media Monitoring Unit, which was connected to 10 Downing Street. The Media Monitoring Unit, then led by Mitchell, is comprised of dozens of people based within the Cabinet Office. They advised the Prime Minister, then Tony Blair, and all major government departments how best to respond to the 24/7 news agenda. British Ambassador John Buck and Robert Henderson, British Consul for the Algarve, would regularly visit the McCanns during the investigation. The McCann family would later say the presence of John Buck put pressure on the Portuguese to ensure everything possible was being done to find Madeleine. In his forthright 2016 blog post, where he wondered so openly about the McCann case, former British ambassador to Uzbekistan, Craig Murray, wrote, "I believe that New Labour's number 10 saw, in typical Blair fashion, a highly photogenic tragedy which there might be popularity in appearing to work on." Craig Murray described how early in his civil servant career, he'd worked in a role akin to a night duty officer for the UK's Foreign Office, the FCO. He said, in his experience, the FCO frequently dealt with gut-wrenching cases of lost or dead children abroad. He wrote, "On average, I'm afraid such tragedies get substantially less than 1% of the public resources that were devoted to the McCanns." Sonia Poulton, who has written extensively for British newspapers and works as a television commentator, she agreed.
"There was a political involvement in this case straight away in Portugal, immediately. And Gonzalo Amaral and the other police involved noted immediately that there was political intervention. Indeed, the woman who was brought in to act as, you know, something of a spokesperson, campaign handler for Kate and Jerry McCann, she was a political animal. And almost all of the people who were involved in, like, you know, acting as their spokespeople, right up to Clarence Mitchell, had all come through the political corridors. Very interesting. And so New Labour were in power at the time. New Labour were heavily invested, and that's the people who are involved in New Labour, including Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, were heavily invested in the notion that Madeleine McCann was abducted, and they still are to this day."
When I spoke with Jim Gamble, he explained the arrival and impact of British investigators in Portugal. Remember, at the time, Jim Gamble was the head of CEOP, the Child Exploitation and Online Protection Centre. He was part of the official police investigation.
"The truth of the matter is local police were out of their depth. When Madeleine first went missing, there was a flurry of activity, as you would expect. I think there was a rush to help. Everybody wanted to be associated with it and seen to be doing what they could to try and find this child."
In 2009, Jim Gamble wrote a scoping report, reviewing and reflecting on the involvement of British police. This report would play a part in Scotland Yard's launching of Operation Grange in 2011. I asked him about that report, what it contained. He acknowledged the arrival of British law enforcement had caused tension.
"Looking back, and it's a long time ago now, I think the word that springs to mind for me is that there was a feeling that it was the intervention of a colonial power. There was no doubt that there was frustration, there was a level of resentment, and not necessarily in the officers working hand in glove day to day with one another, but But at that political level, and certainly at times at a leadership level in policing, that's natural. I mean, you'd expect to see that, and certainly we did see that.
But let's track back to the arrival of the dogs and Mark Harrison and prior deluge. In mid-July, some 2.5 months after Maddie was last seen, a man named Mark Harrison was called to Portugal. Harrison was the national search advisor for all police agencies in the UK. He was Great Britain's leading expert in locating persons missing, abducted or murdered. Harrison's remit was to come to Praia da Luz and build a report solely focused on the theory that Madeline was dead and that her body had been hidden somewhere. He believed, based on a scenario that Maddie had been murdered and her body disposed of by a person on foot or in a car, that there were several key areas that should be re-examined. The creche where Maddie was looked after, the McCann's holiday apartment, or the other Tapas 7 apartments, Robert Murat's house, garden and car, the Praia da Luz beach and shoreline, and a vast open area to the east of Praia da Luz, between the town and a golf course. Harrison's initial report said that that open area to the east afforded many opportunities to dispose of a body in thick vegetation, wells, pockets of soft sand, and natural fissures in the cliffs. To see maps of the areas that Mark Harrison believed should be explored, go to 9.com.au/Maddie. Mark Harrison recommended to Gonzalo Amaral and the Portuguese that they send for a dog handler named Martin Grime and his two Springer Spaniels, Eddie and Keela. Martin Grime and his dogs, Eddie and Keela, seemed to come with stellar credentials. Eddie had been trained to detect cadaver, the odour of a deceased body. Keela had been trained to detect human blood. The thing about cadaver and blood dogs, they're not ordinary police sniffer dogs. As pups, they undergo intensive specialist training. As Martin Grime wrote in his report, Eddie, his cadaver dog, only barks when he finds something. He won't bark at other times, not at other dogs, not at strangers, not at a knock at the door. His dog Keela will only indicate at human blood, not human saliva, semen, sweat or other bodily fluids, just human blood. In one of his police reports, Martin Grime claimed his cadaver dog Eddie had never been wrong in 200 cases. But despite all of that, it's important to note and underline that whatever cadaver and blood dogs do or don't alert to, their signals are not evidence that proves anything or evidence that can be used in court. The work of cadaver dogs needs to be backed up with additional evidence, such as DNA, a confession, or the discovery of a body.
The first thing you've got to remember when you're dealing with dogs trained to find human remains is that the dogs are using their natural instinct, unlike dogs that are trained to find explosives or narcotics. If you imagine a dog that lives in the jungle, say, it's never seen a human being in its life, it doesn't wake up in the morning and say, I'm going to go and find 1 kilo of Semtex or 1 kilo of heroin, but it will say, I'm going to go and find food. And the cadaver to the dog is food. So we're using those very, very basic instincts. I mean, I've actually had a case. It was a court case down on the south coast. It's a few years ago now. And it was basically where a man killed his wife, put her in the study overnight, got up the following morning, took the young children to school, moved her out of the study into one of the three family cars, and buried her in the woodland. So the lady was only in the study 10 hours maximum, something like that, and she was only in the car, say, 1 hour. And she'd only been killed probably 12 hours beforehand. And my dog indicated the area in the study and the car in which she was carried in. And that was after 1 week after the lady's disappearance. There was no blood, there was no trauma there. That was just what we call the scent of death.
That's Mick Swindells, a former police inspector and dog handler who served in the Lancashire Police Force for 30 years. Mick has been training specialist cadaver dogs in the UK and around the world since 1994. He and his dogs have helped search for dead bodies buried by IRA terrorists in Northern Ireland as part of the Good Friday Agreement. I contacted dog handler Martin Grime to talk about the search his dogs conducted in the McCann apartment and the car, but he said because the case remains open with Scotland Yard, he can't speak about details of the search. So instead, I asked Mick Swindells how reliable he thought cadaver dogs could be.
Dogs do make mistakes. People make mistakes, and dogs are no different. Sometimes the dogs make a honest mistake, as people do, whereas they think they've got the scent of what they're looking for, but it's actually something else. But they are a useful tool for any investigator, and we always say that any investigation must be multidisciplinary. If you try to get two various disciplines, say, for instance, say a dog and a ground-penetrating radar, if both of them indicate the same area, then that's a good chance that that's where the body will be.
I asked a cadaver dog trainer in the US, Andy Redman, the same question. Andy is a retired trainer for Connecticut State Police, and he's worked with searching cadaver dogs since the 70s. He now lives in Washington State, where he trains dogs to find narcotics, explosives, and cadaver.
A well-trained team, and I'm talking about a well-trained team, is I would consider them probably between 90 and 95% reliable. I have never met a team that is 100%. And I've worked with hundreds of handlers over the past 45 years. So I have never met a dog team that hasn't had at least one screw up. If you had specific locations and you worked a dog in that area, you should be able to detect whether the body was there. I had one case where a body had been, a young child had been killed accidentally, actually. And the incident occurred in the bedroom. The child was moved to a bathroom and then was put in the refrigerator. And my dog indicated all three locations. And then he was removed from the premises. And he was located subsequently off the premises. But the dog did successfully indicate all three locations where a body had been stored for a brief period of time.
On July 31, 2007, Martin Grime and the two Springer Spaniel dogs began sweeping the locations identified by Mark Harrison. According to an official Portuguese police report, the dogs alerted 13 times in several locations. Eddie the cadaver dog alerted in apartment 5A, where the McCanns had been staying. Eddie signaled in Kate and Jerry's bedroom, close to a wardrobe, and again in the McCanns' living room, behind a blue two-seat sofa. Like Eddie, Keela, the blood dog, alerted behind the sofa. The blue sofa would form a part of Gonzalo Amaral's unproven theory that Maddie might have somehow died in 5A. Outside 5A, Eddie alerted in a flower bed. Martin Grime described that alert as a soft indication. This meant that whatever source Martin Grime's dog was alerting to was a fainter, less strong scent. Portuguese police asked the Ocean Club Resort, the local fire department, and emergency services if there had ever, at any time, been a death inside 5A. The answer was no. No death had ever been recorded in that apartment. In another search, police removed various items of clothing from the villa where the McCanns had relocated after they moved out of 5A. These clothing items were laid out in a special designated area. Eddie alerted to two items of Kate McCann's clothing, a pair of black and white check trousers and a white t-shirt. Eddie also alerted to Maddie's pink soft toy, Cuddle Cat. In an underground car park, 10 cars were brought in and parked up by detectives. Martin Grime did not know who any of the cars belonged to. They were anonymous, which was important, as the subtle body language of a trainer can inadvertently trigger an alert from their dog. The audio you're about to hear of a dog barking is taken from the actual search with Eddie in the car park. During the search of those 10 cars, Eddie alerted by the door of the McCann's Renault Scenic. He also alerted to the car's electronic key. Keeler also alerted to the key. After jumping into the vehicle, Keeler alerted inside the boot of the car. That's the trunk for our American listeners. Unlike Eddie, who barks, Keeler, the blood dog, she indicates by freezing herself dead still. Those signals in and around the car were hard to comprehend because the Renault Scenic was hired by the McCanns 3 weeks after Maddie disappeared. Now that meant either the dogs were giving false alerts or, if they were right, it would seem to indicate a dead body could have been put in the car. It's vital to repeat here that the work of the cadaver and blood dogs, although it could show that a dead body was present, it's not evidence on its own that can be used in court. Additional evidence is required and always sought by police. To see the locations in 5A where Eddie and Keeler alerted, go to 9.com.au/Maddie. Forensic teams moved in, and a number of DNA swabs were taken from apartment 5A and the boot of the rental car. But the DNA samples were small and came back from a British forensic lab judged to be inconclusive. In a later episode, I speak with one of the world's leading forensic scientists to gain deeper insight into that DNA report and to find out if there is actually a way to analyze and decipher those very small, very challenging samples. The dogs did not indicate in any other locations Mark Harrison had urged them to look. Searches of the coastline yielded nothing. Police teams pushed long metal bars into the ground around the vast open area to the east of Praia da Luz, hoping to release cadaver odour if a body had been secretly buried there. But the dogs found nothing. After 8 days, search expert Mark Harrison typed up his report. In it, he noted the work and the indications of the dogs, but he wrote, "No confirmed evidence or information could be taken from the alerts by the dogs. It needed to be confirmed with physical evidence." He added, "Any such indications, without any physical evidence to support them, cannot have any evidential value, being unconfirmed indications. Additionally, I consider no inference can be drawn as to whether a human cadaver has previously been in any location without any other supporting evidence." In short, without DNA or any corroborating evidence, the work of the dogs was of interest, but no more. During my interview with Mick Swindells, I asked him about the work Martin Grime did on the case. Although my conversation with Mick had covered the tremendous capabilities of cadaver dogs, he did express his concern at the way Eddie, Martin Grime's cadaver dog, had alerted to some of the McCann's personal possessions.
I know Martin, I did some work with his dogs when he was still in the police, but all this about the Bible and the teddy and everything is bullshit. Yes, there is such a thing as the scent of death. How long it actually lasts, I'm not sure. And I would very much doubt that the scent of death would last weeks, months. I think it would only last hours and a few days under certain circumstances. Of course, all the circumstances are totally different. If you've got an area exposed to high sunlight, hot temperatures, I would think the scent of death would dissipate quicker than the scent of death, say, on a fabric, sorry, on a tiled floor or something like that in a dark room. So I'm very sceptical about simply using the scent of death because it can't be corroborated in a court. It can only be corroborated with additional evidence.
Mick clearly harboured some doubts about the pink soft toy, Cuddle Cat, and the Bible. But he didn't share with me any concerns about the dog's search inside 5A or the McCann's rental car. Now, the Bible you heard Mick talking about, there was no mention of the Bible in the official police reports. However, several British newspapers did report that Eddie had supposedly alerted to Kate McCann's Bible. I asked Jim Gamble, the one-time head of CEOP, about the cadaver dog search in 5A and the car, and what impression it had left on him.
Well, I mean, look, that drew a lot of attention. I've got a lot of respect for, you know, one of the dog hunters involved, and, you know, the dog had a good history. But an indication from a dog alone, in the absence of any corroboration from other sources, doesn't really give you very much. And I think there are lots of anomalies around the car, the time difference between when the incident happened, when the car was actually taken on as a hire car, and I can see why that would cause people to raise an eyebrow, but there was nothing evidentially to support it in a way that would have made me reflect and think, well, actually, this means more than it does.
1 month after the dog's search had concluded, Portuguese police declared the McCanns arguidos. When the case was eventually shelved in 2008, arguido status was lifted from the McCanns. But in 2017, a Portuguese Supreme Court judge said that the lifting of the McCann's arguido status did not mean that Kate and Jerry were innocent. In press interviews, Jerry McCann said he had extensively researched evidence about cadaver dogs. He called the dogs incredibly unreliable. As part of his research, the McCann's legal team began looking into a very strange murder case that was underway involving Wisconsin man Eugene Zapata. U.S. police believed that Zapata had murdered his flight instructor wife, Jeanette, in 1976. The couple had been embroiled in a messy divorce, and Jeanette's body had never been found. But in 2006, 40 years after his wife went missing, Eugene Zapata was charged with first-degree murder. Part of the police case was built on the back of cadaver dogs alerting in multiple, seemingly impossible places. First, the dogs alerted in the basement of a home Eugene and Jeanette once lived together. Then the dogs alerted at other properties Eugene had owned, and at a storage locker he had rented, and a rental car he used in 2005 while cleaning out the locker. The locations of those alerts seemed a random, a highly improbable pattern. At least that's what Zapata's lawyers and a judge believed. Prosecutors tried and failed to have the cadaver dog evidence entered into Zapata's murder trial. In his ruling, the judge said there was no body and no corroborating evidence. Zapata's legal team, they argued they had found the dogs were incorrect 78%, 71%, and 62% of the time. Of the dog's reliability, the judge said, and I quote, "The state has failed to convince me that it's any more reliable than the flip of a coin." But in the following year, 2008, there was a sudden development. Eugene Zapata confessed to killing Jeanette. He admitted dismembering her and moving her remains around the various locations where the dogs had alerted. To summarize all that, the McCanns had initially held up the Zapata case as proof that cadaver dogs were unreliable. But as it later turned out, the dogs had been 100% right, even when all logic seemed to suggest otherwise. When the Portuguese police shelved the investigation in 2008, they wrote about Martin Grime and his dogs in their 57-page report. The report stated, after long and complex DNA testing of samples taken from 5A and the rental car, there was no other evidence to corroborate the work of Springer Spaniels Eddie and Keeler. I asked retired London Met homicide detective Colin Sutton about Martin Grime, wondering if he'd ever worked alongside the British dog handler during one of the many murder investigations Colin had led.
I know of his work and I know of his reputation. What I would say is that the relatively few occasions when I had cause to use body recovery dogs, cadaver dogs, and that kind of thing, I found them, you know, extremely reliable. And certainly in, you know, one case, finding a body that had been buried in open land for getting on for 10 years. And in another case, inside a building where it was a really odd situation where there were just literally tons and tons of sheets of paper and a physical search by but humans had not revealed anything, but the dog indicated. And eventually when all this paper was removed in amongst it, we found the body. So, you know, I've had some very positive experiences of the way that these dogs work and their ability and their accuracy in finding what you're looking for.
In the next episode of Maddie, the crucial DNA evidence taken from a car hired 3 weeks after Madeline went missing.
They recovered some DNA from an item, luggage compartment section. What this report says is there is a possibility that Madeline McCann's DNA is present in this mixture.
I speak with one of the world's leading DNA scientists, and in a remarkably candid conversation, he tells me how he can quite easily solve the forensic riddle that baffled British DNA scientists 10 years ago. The Maddie podcast is reported, written, and narrated by me, Mark Salnokonoko. Dan McHugh is our producer and sound designer. Simon King is our editorial advisor and editor. You can read more about this case and the podcast and see interactive graphics and maps on 9.com.au.